Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, calls for calm after the publication of profit cartoons in France.
I have faced the wrath of both Islamic extremists by way of facing their gunshots in Mumbai, and I have had far-right white extremist groups surround my home whilst my wife and family were inside and absolutely terrified. And therefore, it's absolutely essential that people like me step forward and speak for the majority.
Also on Inside Europe, USAID gets its marching orders from the Kremlin. And London's skyline gets a sustainable crystal. Those stories and more coming up. The flames of protests in the Muslim world have been fueled by the publication in France of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. The satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo published the cartoons on Wednesday. Some show the Prophet naked. The renewed anger follows worldwide protests after an anti-Islam film was posted on the internet. Sajjad Karim is a British Muslim and a member of the European Parliament. I asked him for his reaction to the French cartoons.
I certainly believe and find that this particular publication is offensive. It is insulting. But one then has to bear in mind that this is an issue of individual editorial decision making. And for instance, in my own country, in the United Kingdom, there has not been any such publications carried out, not through any government diktat of any sort, but simply through editorial decision making. And here the editor has made a decision which I think is not in the interests of either his magazine or indeed of France on an international scale, bearing in mind what is happening presently. It's simply the wrong decision in the current circumstances.
Indeed, over the last week or so, we've seen angry demonstrations and sometimes deadly anti-Western attacks in Muslim countries because of that film that was posted on the internet. Are tensions between the Christian and Muslim worlds reaching a tipping point, do you think?
I think it's highly unfortunate that we find ourselves where the whole agenda is today being dictated by a minority of extremes. It's quite clear that this is a very much a minority and extremist interest that has created this movie in the first place, and there has been, therefore, in many ways, a very understandable reaction in certain quarters, because what you have to bear in mind is that in many of the countries where demonstrations have taken place, sometimes very peaceful, other times in a very violent way, they are countries in which there is very little understanding amongst the masses of one simple fact, that in the United States of America, and certainly in the European Union, governments simply do not have control over the media in the way that the populations in these countries may think that they have. And it's that fundamental misunderstanding which is leading to these reactions. Having said that, I have viewed the movie. I did find it deeply insulting. It is a movie which has no factual basis or content whatsoever. And therefore, I can well understand that people's sensitivities will be pushed to the limits.
Do you get a sense that, at least here in Europe, moderate Muslims are becoming radicalised as a result of these cartoons and the film poking fun at the Prophet?
I have not seen any evidence of that sort of movement taking place at all. What I have seen is that the overwhelming vast majority of Muslims in Europe have voiced their opinions in within the democratic norms that are available to them in a very peaceful way. But what you have here, as I have said right at the outset, is a small minority of extremists who have made this movie. They do not represent Western or Christian viewpoint at all, and neither do the small minority of extremists who have responded in a very violent way represent European Muslims either.
Well, indeed, many Christians would agree that these cartoons are a provocation, so there is a degree of unity here.
Well, I think one of the things that is happening through this ongoing process is that whilst many of these people who undertake these actions do it with a view to creating a split amongst the faith communities, I think ultimately it has the opposite effect. It brings those who believe in interfaith harmony to a point of more commitment to understand one another more and accept one another's viewpoint more. So I think ultimately they are defeating the purpose for which they set out on these endeavours.
What about the right wing, though? Is it benefiting from these incidents?
Well, as I say, it's the extremes that are providing oxygen to one another. It's a pendulum effect where one set of extremes needs the other set of extremes to operate in a certain way in order for them to have the oxygen to then react. And then that reaction causes a further reaction by the originating extreme, if I can put it in those terms. So that's the sort of situation we are in, and through new mass forms of communication that are so easily and readily available for abuse by people, they are being used and manipulated in this very unfortunate way.
Just finally, Mr. Karim, you're no stranger to religious violence. I believe you were in the Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai when it was attacked in 2008. And you've experienced death threats and harassment from far-right groups like the English Defence League. Most of us, fortunately, don't have that first-hand experience. Has it changed your outlook on humanity?
It certainly made me ever more determined to ensure that these minority extremists are not allowed to dominate the agenda. I have faced the wrath of both Islamic extremists by way of facing their gunshots in Mumbai, and I have had far-right, white supremacist extremist groups surround my home whilst my wife and family were inside and absolutely terrify them. However, the point is this, that these small extremist groups do not represent anybody other than the small clique of warped thinking that their very few members hold. And therefore, it's absolutely essential that people like me step forward and speak for the majority. And the majority are the right-thinking people who absolutely abhor all of these people that carry out these actions, whether they may be the Anders Breiviks of this world or whether indeed it may be people associated with Al-Qaeda. They are the minority, they are the extremists, we are the majority, and we will face them.
And that was Sajjad Karim, Britain's first Muslim member of the European Parliament, speaking there from Brussels. Well, Denmark has been in the crosshairs of hardline Muslims since 2005, when a Danish cartoonist depicted the Prophet Muhammad as having a missile in his turban. Members of Hizbut Tahrir, an extreme Islamist organisation banned in some countries, has now used the internet video as an excuse to attack the United States. From Copenhagen, Malcolm Brabant reports.
About 500 members of Hizbut Tahrir clustered opposite the United States Embassy in Copenhagen and directed their invective not just towards the controversial video, but also at America for its military adventures in the Middle East and Afghanistan. One of Hizbut Tahrir's senior members, Jawid Yosef, whipped up the crowd by reiterating the main tenet of the organization's manifesto, the establishment of a worldwide caliphate or Islamic State.
The world has to understand, and especially the Western governments and the U.S. has to understand, there is a line, there is a border that you do not cross. If you cross this border, you take the consequences. Our love for the Prophet requires more than coming here today. This is indeed true. It requires a state that will uphold, that will protect the honor of the Prophet, that will protect the honor and the lives of every Muslim, man and woman on this earth, and will protect the wealth of the Muslim. And no Khalifa will not condone the killing of an ambassador. This is not the solution. It will not condone the burning of American flags. This will not solve anything. Rather, the Khilafah will remove every single U.S. embassy from the Islamic soil. The Khilafah will remove every single U.S. company.
some female demonstrators carried placards saying freedom of expression is a means to oppression. When Danish embassies around the Muslim world were being attacked after the Cartoons publication, the government in Copenhagen resoundingly defended the principle of free expression. But in Washington, the crass nature of the internet video made it easy to disown by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Let me state very clearly, and I hope it is obvious, that the United States government had absolutely nothing to do with this video. We absolutely reject its content and message.
The United States' line is that dialogue is far more constructive than demonstrations, but Hizbul Tahrir is turning a deaf ear. Shadi Freji is the organization's spokesman.
The problem we are dealing with should not be reduced into this movie. It's a long series of insults toward the Prophet and Islam in general that we have been witnessing for the last decade now. And it is due to the climate that the Americans and European politicians has created through their so-called war on terror, or what Bush described at the time as the crusade. It is a result of this intolerant, Islamophobic climate produced by the British, the American, the European politicians and their actions in the Muslim world and all over the world. So we do not consider the problem as this single movie, but it is actually the climate that produces or that will lead to such insults.
In terms of insults, which is worse, the cartoons that were drawn in Denmark or this film which was created in the United States?
It's a strange question. It doesn't, for a Muslim, there isn't you know, a measurement. An insult is an insult. And when you have a long series of insults, it is not the insults itself that is the most bothering, but it is the reasons behind these insults. And we're talking about a specific policy that has led to these kind of insults.
So first of all, I'd like to tell the enemy to look very closely at this flag, at the black flag, not the white flag, but the black flag. Because this is the black flag that the U.S. will see coming over the horizon. This is the black flag they will see coming across the Atlantic in front of an army that loves the Prophet, that loves Islam more than they love life, money, and women.
Denmark's experience is one that will be shared by the United States. Demonstrations against the cartoons may have vanished, but 6 years on, Muslim anger has never gone away. The video, Innocence of Muslims, will also never be forgotten. Malcolm Brabant, DW, Copenhagen.
Russia has given the United States Agency for International Development until the 1st of October to close its operations and leave the country. USAID is a major donor to pro-democracy and human rights groups in Russia. And this decision comes after the Kremlin passed a new law over the summer branding such groups in Russia as foreign agents. As Jessica Gollaher reports from Moscow, this latest move is a further sign that President Vladimir Putin is looking to get rid of groups that monitor internal affairs in his country.
The expulsion order comes after the Kremlin accused USAID of trying to influence Russia's internal politics. The foreign ministry says it's concerned that USAID has been working to influence elections in Russia, mainly by funding civil society institutions through grants and other forms of financial support. USAID currently funds nearly 60 organizations that fight to promote democracy and human rights in Russia. Just a few months ago, the Kremlin passed a controversial law that brands all NGOs in Russia receiving funds from abroad as foreign agents. Russian President Vladimir Putin has consistently maintained that foreign countries, primarily the United States, orchestrated the massive protests that erupted after parliamentary elections last December. Lilia Shibanova is executive director of Golos, the only independent election monitoring agency in Russia. Her organization is one of the many that will have to close their doors in a matter of weeks.
This is a strong blow to Russia because USAID supported human rights organizations, environmental protection centers, and many other civil projects. USAID really had a huge impact, and to lose it will be very difficult.
Shibanova also says that the timing of the expulsion makes it obvious that the Kremlin does not want anyone monitoring its activities.
You know, the deadline that was set, October 1st, does raise serious doubts. Because on the 14th of October, there will be large-scale regional elections. We believe the two are directly related, and it's a further sign that Putin doesn't want anyone monitoring these elections.
Memorial, a leading human rights group, will also be forced to leave as a result of the order. Many analysts say the expulsion does not bode well for Russia's less than stellar human rights or democracy record. In the few months since Mr. Putin reclaimed the presidency for an unprecedented third term, the country has seen a significant crackdown on dissent, including the increase of fines for participating in and organizing unsanctioned protests. Around 60% of USAID's $50 million budget for this year went to human rights groups like Memorial. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, USAID has given billions of dollars to groups in Russia to protect the environment, develop a stronger civil society, combat infectious diseases, and modernize the economy. Jessica Gallagher, DW Moscow.
And I'm Helen Sinian Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. London is known for iconic old structures like Big Ben and London Bridge. Some know it too for modern buildings like the cucumber-shaped Gherkin and the Shard skyscraper, which resembles a piece of broken glass. Well, this week, the Munich-based company Siemens added the most modern of buildings to London's roster. It's called The Crystal, and it's one of the most energy-efficient and low-carbon buildings in the world, with a sustainability exhibition at its core. Kyle McKinnon has more.
It's a good bet that you saw East London highlighted during the Summer Olympics and Paralympics. It's an industrialized part of the city known for closed production lines and social problems. But on the way back, it's hoped, thanks to the construction of the Olympic Park.
I'm walking along a waterway in this part of London on land called the Royal Docks. Above me, the sprawling Crystal. London Mayor Boris Johnson says it's breathed new life into this area, a boost to ambitious plans to redevelop former industrial land in order, he says, to bring jobs to the capital.
Well, 50 jobs, actually, on a 35 million euro investment by Siemens. But in this futuristic multi-angled glass structure, London, Siemens, and green infrastructure experts see the potential for major business and job opportunities globally and a chance to help guide the smart cities agenda of the planet.
This is a global center.
That's Siemens chief executive Peter Lesher.
This center is a knowledge hub. What we wanted to do on top of it is to use London as the global knowledge hub for our very important initiatives.
Lesher says his core team at the Crystal includes experts of 15 nationalities, so mayors and especially their urban planners and infrastructure specialists are expected to visit here for what the Crystal's project manager, Werner Krückau, says will be lively debate on solving problems like traffic, air quality, water, police, energy, access to healthcare, burgeoning urban populations. The list goes on.
I really mean it like this. If we believe in megatrends and the changes needed in the world, then this is the place to debate it.
You have different buildings.
Design your own sustainable building.
Probably learn and debate, actually.
This area has been affected severely by flooding, so it was clear that our policy...
The Crystal's 6,300 square meter footprint includes a 2,000 square meter interactive exhibition on the future of urbanization. It's the largest of its kind, Siemens says. More than half of all people live in urban areas these days, and by 2050, the World Health Organization says it will be 7 out of 10 of us. The exhibition's aim is to show how cities might change to sustain us all.
5:36 p.m., London. Journeys across the city take people and packages.
Mayor Boris Johnson sees a lot of good coming from the investment in a part of his city where industrial decay has been the rule.
Technological progress can make a huge difference, and problems that were thought to be insoluble can suddenly disappear.
The River Thames carries hydrogen and solar-powered vessels. A cleaner Thames provides...
All of this, the exhibition, the building's green energy production from solar and ground source heat pumps, the harvested rainwater, but especially that exhibition and the experts housed at the Crystal, all are geared toward decision makers in smart cities and those other cities that are still learning, according to Richard Forster, editor of the publication Cities Today.
That's new. That's the big development. The urbanization development is that the city governments now are getting far more influence, both in terms of what they can spend and how they make the decisions. It's a long way to go, but I think the national governments are realizing that as well, and therefore people like Siemens are targeting the cities direct rather than national governments.
It's a big development globally, according to Forrester, but what about this physical development of the land and the Crystal locally, specifically in the London borough of Newham, where 50 new jobs doesn't sound like a lot for such a big investment, says Newham newspaper reporter Melissa York and many of her readers.
I think it's more maybe bafflement that the local people feel at the moment. They don't really see how it's connected to their environment and to their lives. I don't know if this is beneficial to the people, beneficial to the general infrastructure and regeneration of the area, which are two very different things.
Siemens thinks the Crystal will be beneficial to both in the long run. The company is quick to point out it provides more than 18,000 jobs already in the UK. And now it's hoping the 50 new employees and those brought here from elsewhere in the company can push cities and their residents to turn a corner on low-carbon, energy-efficient living. Gordon Wakeford heads up Siemens' infrastructure and cities sector in the UK and Western Europe.
That isn't just about technology. That's about political will. That's about cultural change. And technology can go a long, long way to support that. That's what we're showing next door. But it won't solve it all.
London's Crystal is hosting conferences already and will open to the general public on the 29th of September. Kyle McKinnon, DW, London.
Years ago this month, it was the beginning of the end for Napoleon's invasion of Russia. His army won the Battle of Borodino on September the 7th and continued its march to Moscow. But a ruined city awaited them, and Napoleon was forced to retreat. It's one of the most important events in Russian history and inspired one of Tchaikovsky's most well-known pieces of music, the 1812 Overture. But do you know this version of the 1812 Overture? It's just been released by an American band to coincide with the anniversary. And for this month's quiz, we want you to tell us the name of the band. Is it A, Napoleon's Revenge, B, The Invincible Tsars, or C, The Revolting Peasants? Our email address is europe@dw.de. That's europe@dw.de. Or you can write to us at Inside Europe, the European desk, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany, and we'll announce our five winners next month. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Over the next half hour, tensions escalate between Turkey and its Kurdish minority. Czech bootleg booze is causing a scare in Eastern Europe. Walls go up to separate Roma from Romanians, and will pedal power take over the streets of Brussels?
We want the people of Brussels to think about the way they move in the city. Most people use the car, even for short distances, and we want them to change that.
Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Police in the Czech Republic are racing to find the source of an outbreak of fatal alcohol poisonings that's claimed the lives of at least 20 people. All alcohol over 20% in strength has been banned as the authorities try to deal with the crisis caused by bootleg spirits containing the toxic chemical methanol. An organisation representing Czech spirits producers has said as much as 20% of all hard alcohol sold in the country is produced illegally. Rob Cameron has the following report.
The Czech Health Minister, Leoš Heger, beginning what's become a now daily briefing of a special task force set up to deal with the country's worst outbreak of alcohol poisoning in decades. The death toll has crept up towards the 24 mark as people have been drinking what they thought were cheap local versions of rum and vodka. The drinks, however, were tainted with the industrial spirit methanol, used, among other things, for making antifreeze and screen wash. Police are seizing ever larger quantities of bootleg spirits in raids across the country, and the most recent finds, said Mr. Heger, were simply breathtaking.
The most serious case comes from the fire brigade, who are helping the police with this investigation. They identified in various barrels a total of 260 liters of alcohol with a methanol content of 20-30%. That's the most toxic dose imaginable, and could perhaps be described, I'm exaggerating here a bit, but only slightly, as a weapon of mass destruction.
The authorities are registering around 5 new cases of methanol poisoning each day, mostly concentrated in the depressed northeast of the country, with some cases reported elsewhere, including Prague. When methanol is metabolized in the body, it begins to cause irrevocable damage to vital organs, causing blindness, liver failure, and often death. Paradoxically, a dose of drinking alcohol, i.e. ethanol, can halt the metabolizing process, so the best thing victims can do is down a shot of good quality spirits. But help has arrived too, in the form of an effective though expensive antidote called formepizole. 80 boxes of formepizole, enough to treat around 24 people, were donated by Norway and rushed to Prague by poisons expert Dr. Knut Erik Hovda from the Nuclear, Biological and Chemical Centre in Oslo. I spoke to him by telephone shortly before he went into a meeting at Ostrava Hospital.
It's highly effective. It binds extremely strongly to the enzyme, meaning if you are admitted early enough to hospital, we're pretty sure that we can save your life. The problem being that a lot of these patients are admitted very late. And dependent on their clinical condition when they're admitted to hospital, that might tell us something about the outcome of the patient. But the formepizole itself is highly efficient.
Dr. Hofda was depicted as something of an angel of mercy in the Czech media, and formepizole has now been administered in a number of cases. The Czech authorities are now reported to be buying up supplies of the drug. But as police continue to seize bootleg booze and arrest those involved in producing and supplying it, the legitimate businesses that sell and serve alcohol are feeling the effects of a form of partial prohibition introduced by Mr. Heger, an almost unprecedented step for a European country in 2012. Bars and restaurants are trying to come up with ingenious prohibition cocktails containing liqueurs such as Baileys and Kahlúa, which have an alcohol content of less than 20%. The big producers, meanwhile, suffering a massive hit in profits, are mulling legal action to win compensation for the shortfall in profits. Some bars warn they could go out of business. The veteran anti-alcohol campaigner, Dr. Karol Neszpor, told me while he had great sympathy for the victims of the methanol crisis, it threatened to overshadow a far more serious health problem facing society, that of regular alcohol consumption.
Of course, it is a very unpleasant and painful experience for many people and their families, but you see, the much, much greater number of people are killed not because of methyl alcohol, but because of ethyl alcohol, because of so-called high-quality alcoholic beverages. For example, a traffic accident definitely kills much more people than methyl alcohol.
Few will heed his call. According to WHO figures, the Czech Republic boasts the second highest per capita alcohol consumption in the world after Moldova, although most of that is accounted for by their huge consumption of beer. But people are angry that it's come to this, and two very good questions remain unanswered. How have criminals been able to produce staggering quantities of illegal spirits from industrial alcohol that was never meant for human consumption in the first place? And how have those spirits found their way into the supply chain? Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
In Turkey, the conflict between the Turkish state and the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, appears to be rapidly escalating. This week, at least 20 security force members were killed, while the government claims in the last month over 500 rebels have died. But the conflict could get a lot worse, with calls for parliamentary deputies of the pro-Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party to be expelled from parliament and prosecuted. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Nine members of Turkey's pro-Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party, BDP, embracing and chatting with members of the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. The encounter, captured on TV, has provoked a political storm in Turkey. It comes as the PKK, which is fighting for autonomy, has intensified operations against the Turkish state. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, addressing his conservative supporters, promised action.
If they are looking for a more comfortable place, I will give them an address. They can go to the Kandil Mountains and join the PKK. But if they want to work within this parliament, they must act within the framework of the constitution and the law. Otherwise, we've already told the judiciary what is necessary. The judiciary is doing what is necessary. We will also do what is necessary in Parliament.
At the moment, what is necessary can't exactly be done. All Turkish deputies enjoy immunity from prosecution. But that can be lifted by a parliamentary vote. Supporters of the 44 Kurdish journalists on trial early this month in Istanbul under the country's anti-terrorism law. The trial is part of an ongoing legal crackdown on the pro-Kurdish movement. Currently, over 7,000 members and officials of the BDP have been detained as part of the probe. Attending the journalists' trial is BDP deputy Ertuğrul Kukçu. If his immunity is lifted, he too could face trial for his encounter with the PKK rebels. But Kukçu says that would be absurd.
They talked to us and we talked to them and they gave a hug and what could we do? We reacted like a civilized person. Maybe some of us had more smiling face than the others, but these are not a matter of judiciary, but this is a matter of culture, not even politics. But this was a justification for the Prime Minister to unfold his schemes against BDP because BDP is voice of the popular uprising.
The controversy comes as fighting between the PKK and Turkish security forces continues to escalate. Ambulances rushing the dead and injured from the latest PKK attack. On Tuesday, an army convoy was hit, killing at least 10 soldiers, injuring more than 60. 12 other security force members were killed in attacks only days before. Political scientist Cengiz Aktar of Istanbul's Bahçeşehir University warned any parliamentary vote to lift the deputy's immunity threatens to escalate the conflict even further.
It would mean the end of the political process. There will be more alienation of the Kurds, for sure. This alienation among the youngsters is already there. I think now we may end up in alienating even the integrated Kurds, who, although against violent action, are nevertheless voting for the BDP. Because we shouldn't forget that the BDP has 2.5 million votes.
1994 was the last time Parliament voted to remove the immunity of pro-Kurdish deputies. At that time, four parliamentarians were prosecuted and convicted, and each served 10 years in jail for threatening the integrity of the state. Their jailing is widely blamed for inflaming the conflict with the PKK, which peaked in the 90s. Although the political situation is now very different, parallels with that bloody era are now increasingly being drawn. Soli Özel is a professor of international relations at Istanbul's Kadir Has University.
In the 1990s, we only had the vestiges of an Iraqi Kurdish political entity in the making. We now have almost a full-fledged state, which is quasi-independent, very autonomous. Second in Syria for the moment, yet another possibility for another Kurdish entity. The Kurds are coming to the stage of history and basically claiming what they were unable to get in the settlement of 1918-22, when the Brits and the French basically put together the political geography and the system that we know.
But with local, presidential and general elections scheduled in the next 3 years, the fate of the BDP deputies may ultimately rest with voting calculations, according to political columnist Asla Aydıntaşbaş of the Turkish Milliyet newspaper.
He's just like every politician. He wants to do better in the upcoming elections. He wants to be the president of Turkey, and this is an overwhelmingly Turkish country. And unfortunately, over the last few years, Turkey has become more polarized in society between Kurds and Turks. So part of it is he's just looking at numbers and he knows which constituency to play to.
Death to the PKK, mourners chant at the latest funerals of soldiers killed by the rebels. With such funerals occurring nearly every day, the calls to prosecute the pro-Kurdish deputies are also getting louder. The fate of the deputies may well be determined by whether prosecutors decide to file cases against them. For with fighting continuing to intensify with the PKK, it will be difficult for the ruling party to oppose any vote that lifts their immunity, whatever the consequences. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Well, we turn to another minority, Gypsies or Roma. A substantial number of them live in Romania. They often live in separate parts of towns and villages, or even in entirely separate settlements. However, in recent years, social tensions have led two towns in different parts of Romania to build walls, physically separating the two communities. Tom Wilson has been visiting those towns to find out more.
I'm here in Terlungen, a picturesque village in Transylvania, home to some 20,000 people. Around 30% of the population here are Roma, or Gypsies. However, a wall has been built blocking a road that connects their community with the rest of the town. The Roma children are especially unhappy.
The wall's too high. We can't go to school anymore. We have to take the long way around, all the way past the post office. The mayor doesn't give us any help. We get nothing. We can't go and play football or go play games outside. They should knock down the wall and let us play.
I asked them if they had friends on the other side of the wall.
Yes. There are other children on the other side, Gypsies too. There used to be an old mill for wheat and corn. We used to go past it, turn right, we'd be right at school. Then we were never late for classes.
The wall is far too high to see over. It's around 3 meters, built of concrete blocks and covered with sharp shards of glass at the top.
a băga sticle.
De termopan.
Da, de alea și care te-a înțăpat numai o țâră.
They put pieces of glass up there. Glass from windows. If you cut yourself on them, you'll die.
However, here, on the other side of the wall, the Romanians seem happy with the result. I spoke to one man who lives right opposite the new wall.
The children from the gypsy village were always out here on the street. They played here. An accident could have happened. They made fun of elderly people. If an old man or woman passed by, they'd make fun of them and even throw stones at them.
However, the gypsies believe that any social problems stem from poverty.
Jobs, that's the first thing. They should give gypsies jobs so they can earn their bread. Then there wouldn't be any crime at all.
Some Roma families live in wattle-and door buildings with no amenities besides a communal well or water tap. They feel the wall is a waste of resources.
In other communities in this county, they have asphalt roads all the way into the countryside. Here we have a dirt road full of rocks and stones. This is a prison wall. It's exactly the kind of wall they have in prison.
And the children complain of discrimination at school.
They say we're dirty and full of fleas. They say they have to open the windows.
The wall in Terlungen was constructed in 2009. However, in the summer of 2011, a similar wall went up almost 250 miles away in the northern Romanian city of Baia Mare. The wall here in Baia Mare is a little lower and isn't covered in glass, but it's much more extensive, almost encircling a cluster of tower blocks where there's a large gypsy community along with some poor Romanians. It's a shocking sight. The blocks are all smoke blackened from improvised fires inside the apartments, since there's no heating and no running water or sanitation either. However, the people who live behind the wall are divided over whether it's a good thing or not.
Of course, they did a good thing for the kids. It's for their protection. I have a child and he was hit by a car. It's for our own good. Kids don't know what they're doing. If a football goes into the road, who knows what could happen?
They should pull it down. We shouldn't be locked up like in prison. We're like prisoners here.
I met up with the local mayor, Cătălin Cherecheș. He says that the wall was put up solely to stop local children from running out into the busy road that runs alongside the tower blocks.
There are many children there from poor families whose parents often don't live with them. They've left to go abroad. The children are left on their own, and they'd hang around in the middle of the road. There were lots of accidents. In the first 6 months of last year, there were more than 20 accidents involving children.
This wall is also made of concrete blocks and is too high for me to see over. I asked the mayor why it has to look so intimidating.
In my opinion, it looks good as it is. If we'd made it of wood, then by November people would have started to use it for firewood. And if we'd made it of metal, then it would have disappeared after a day because someone would have sold the metal.
Alexandru Banta is an active member of Roma community organizations and lives behind the wall. He took me back to his home to meet his family to see what conditions are really like here.
It's like being under house arrest. The kids can't see out and people can't see in. What are we hiding behind this wall? Poor families, that's what.
His wife introduced me to the family.
I have 14 children. The oldest is 28, and the youngest, a girl, is 1 year and 4 months.
13 people from three different generations live in this one tiny room. The only source of heat is a small improvised wooden stove. The room's extremely damp, and the younger children suffer from very bad asthma. I can even hear one of them wheezing as he sleeps.
What do we do for water? Well, it's very difficult to manage. Around the back of the block, which is where we get the water from, is covered in rubbish. If I want to wash the children, I have to make a wood fire, heat the water, and give them a bath in a bucket. There's no other way. Lots of people say, oh, the gypsies do this, the gypsies do that. They simply marginalise us.
The National Council for Combating Discrimination officially condemned the walls I visited, but they're still standing. It remains to be seen whether others like them will spring up elsewhere. They might be controversial, but they seem popular with the electorate. The mayor of Baia Mare was re-elected with the highest share of the vote anywhere in Romania. Building walls might seem like a solution for some, but it seems to be making social integration an increasingly distant prospect. Tom Wilson, DW, Romania.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. It's been European Mobility Week, an annual campaign to promote what's called sustainable urban mobility, which means about anything other than a car. But for the city of Brussels, sustainable mobility isn't just about the environment. The Belgian capital is considered one of Europe's most congested cities. Yet even its legendary traffic jams haven't been enough to get most residents out on their bikes. But now, cyclists in Brussels are taking their fight to the streets. Our reporter, James Paniki, unleashed some pedal power of his own for the annual Sunday Without Cars event, and he filed this report.
It's 9 a.m. on a fine Sunday morning, and the streets of Brussels have been transformed. Gone is the traffic, the noise, and the pollution. It feels like Copenhagen, or at least what Belgium's often underappreciated cyclists assume that bike-friendly cities like Copenhagen must feel like. There's a party on in the square in front of the Brussels Central Station today, and everyone's invited. That is, everyone who's prepared to get here either by public transport or by bike. Bruno de Lille is the Secretary for Mobility in the Brussels capital government, which covers all of the Greater Brussels area. And he's hoping the Carless Sunday event leaves a mark.
It is important because we want the people of Brussels to think about the way they move in the city. Most people use the car, even for short distances. And we want them to change that because, we see you have traffic jams everywhere all the time, and we want to change that. So we have a mobility plan which says that we give priority to the people who walk, to the people who use the bicycle, and to the public transport.
The Brussels capital region has set itself the goal of cutting the car pressure on the city by 20% within the next 6 years. And Mr. De Lille admits that won't be easy.
Since the 60s, Brussels has invested in car infrastructure. So if you look at public space, 75% of public space is used for car lanes, for parking places. So we have to change that. And we are doing that now. So we are creating infrastructure for bicycles. We are creating free lanes for buses and trams. But of course, it's the beginning of the change and it will take some time.
If the Belgian capital is truly set to embrace cycling, then the country's northern neighbour is ready to harness the boom. The Dutch government's stand here at the Car Free Day features a number of battery-powered bikes made in Holland. Peter Broelmans is from the Dutch embassy.
In Amsterdam, 50% of all trips are made on a bike. In Brussels, I would guess it's around 1 or 2%.
Is that a cultural reason or is it government policy? Why is that?
I think it has to do with culture. For Dutch people, a bike is something you use every day and for any purpose, whether you go to school, to work, whether it's recreational, you use a bike. Everybody has a bike. There's about 18 million bikes for 60 million people, so there's more than one bike per person. I don't know how much it would be in Brussels, but I guess not even 10%, maybe 5% of the people own a bike. So there you see a complete different way of behaving with bikes.
I heard that Bruno Relin has some crazy idea.
Efforts to make Brussels more bike-friendly are receiving strong support from some of the city's die-hard cyclists. Finnish-German Karl-Heinz Pohl is the owner of Pedal Brussels Bike Couriers. He shot to prominence last year thanks to an online documentary about the city's seemingly intractable traffic problems. Back then, Mr. Pohl was fiercely critical of government policy. But today he's upbeat about the future of cycling, although he says that for the culture to change, governments need to make tough decisions. I caught up with him at a sushi bar where he was about to collect his first package for a Sunday delivery.
Good example is my wife. She's a bike-wise normal lady, nothing to do with, like me, a bike fanatic. And when we lived in Barcelona, she did everything with bike. Going to work, going out in the night, everything. When we moved back to Brussels, which is her home city, she only drives today. So that's a good example. Infrastructure has something to do with it.
What needs to be done?
They have to have the courage to make some decisions, meaning you just make car-free zones. If I go to Germany, it's fantastic. Munich, Hamburg, all the shopping areas, it's Fußgänger area. The pedestrian areas, it's no access.
Whatever it means for the city's transport problems, there's no doubt that the annual car-free Sunday in Brussels was a hit with families. People were out in droves, taking full advantage of the safe and often empty streets.
We visited the city of Brussels with the family, because there are no cars today.
Would you come here on any other day on your bicycle with your family?
Not at all. It's much too dangerous with all the cars and motorcycles, so that's not the way to do it with the family normally.
So why are you here today?
We're here with our family enjoying the weather and being outside and not driving.
Does it make a difference to you that there's no traffic on the street today?
Oh yeah, it's been great. The kids have been driving around in the middle of the road and it's been good.
What does Brussels need to do to be a bit more bike friendly, do you think?
I think it is pretty bike friendly. You know, if I, as an adult, I would ride a bike around the city for sure. The bike lanes seem really well laid out compared to, you know, Manhattan or somewhere in the States where we're from. And people seem to respect the bikes, so they stop and wait for them to go by. But I wouldn't send the kids out alone.
On the streets of Brussels, this is James Paniki for DW.
Quand on partait de bon matin, quand on partait sur les chemins, à bicyclette. Nous étions quelques bons copains, il y avait Fernand, il y avait Firmin, il y avait Francis et Sébastien, et puis Paulette. On était tous amoureux d'elle, on se sentait pousser les ailes à bicyclette.
And that's all we have time for on the show. Hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to give us some feedback. If you have a comment or a query, you can email us. Our address is europe@dw.de. That's europe@dw.de. Or you can write to us the old-fashioned way at Inside Europe, the European Desk, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. We'd love to hear from you. Today's programme was produced with help from Gabriel Borud and sound engineer Marion Kulliner. And I'm Helen Sini. Thanks for joining me. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.
Puis on se roulait dans les champs, faisant naître un bouquet changeant de sauterelles, de papillons et de rainettes. Quand le soleil à l'horizon profilait sur tous les buissons nos silhouettes, on revenait fourbu content, le cœur un peu vague pourtant de n'être pas un seul instant avec Paulette. Prendre furtivement sa main, oublier un peu les copains, la bicyclette. On se disait, c'est pour demain, j'oserai, j'oserai demain, quand on ira sur les chemins. Ah.